Welcome to our DC Diversity Dive, a podcast in which our diversity and inclusion team aim to recognize and support cultural practices and celebrations. By recognizing and supporting these occasions, which are an important part of many people's lives and well-being, we help to enable an inclusive and diverse environment in which everyone can thrive, regardless of their race, culture, or background. I'm Dani, Delta Capita Management Consultant and Wellness Lead, and today I'll be your host. Mental Health Awareness Week is an annual event enabling opportunities for all of us to focus on reflecting and achieving good mental health. At Delta Capita, we consider well-being a critical part of our organization, constantly developing ways to create an environment where we can feel supported, safe, and accepted. This year's theme is anxiety. This is normal emotion in all of us, but sometimes it can get out of control and become a mental health problem. This is an ideal time for all of us to think about mental health, tackle stigma, and find how we can create a society that prevents mental health problems from developing and protect our mental well-being. In the UK, millions of individuals experience negative stress reactions. Health and safety executive data shows there were an estimated 914,000 cases of work-related stress, depression, anxiety in 2021 to 2022. That's about a million people. This increase has been particularly steep since the start of the COVID pandemic. Another study by the Champion Health shows that 60% of people experience anxiety, 70% of people experience stress, and 56% experience depression, with male statistics around the 50% mark and female statistics around the 60% mark. That is, if we think about it, half or over half of the population. Today, we look to discuss some of the difficulties people face and how to embody our value of being courageous with our guest speakers, Mike, Laura, and Stuart. Welcome. Great to have you here. Our first question is, what comes to mind when you hear the term mental health? And what does mental health really mean to you?
I think we should probably start by some level setting or some definitions. I feel like we all have mental health. It's a spectrum from bad to good, which sometimes is below an individual's norm or comfortable level, which is commonly what people mean when they use the term mental health. It's a state of health that someone's not satisfied with or affects their life or work in some way. I'd say that my view is that it's as important as one's physical health, but it's often overlooked and certainly underfunded. And in the context of unwell mental health, I suppose, connotations, it can be a wide range of challenges, from anxiety to depression, from bipolar to eating disorders, from OCD, PTSD, self-harm, etc. Forgive me, I probably can't list them all. Many of the challenges, I think, could be temporary, they could fluctuate, or they could be ongoing. But it's worth also considering the fictions about mental health. So the fact that someone having challenges with their mental health being a sign of weakness, I would want to dispel, and the people with mental health challenges can't work, or people with such issues could be unpredictable or violent or something like that. Those are the sorts of myths that we want to dispel by normalizing the conversation. Does anyone want to add to that sort of set of definitions of mental health?
Yeah, I think that's really, really accurate. And I think something to also that's also important to think about is how mental health is impacted. So obviously with physical health, there's, I guess, a couple of aspects. It could be a hereditary thing, or you could just pick up a bug from living life. And similarly with mental health, it could be something that actual mental health illness that's passed down, or it could be something that's just impacted by everyday life. You know, you could have increased stress at work and that could increase your anxiety levels. There's so much that impacts it. And just because it's hidden doesn't mean that it doesn't matter.
Yeah, just to add to Laura's point, I think for me, when I think about mental health, I think about what I can do to improve my mental health. Though, but before that, I also think about how I am feeling in myself, and it's okay to feel up or down. And if I am feeling down, what do I need to do to improve my mental health? So a lot of my mindset's around how can I improve my mental health? So whether that's going to the gym, whether it's drinking water, whether it's improving my sleep, whether it's connecting with friends or family, my big thing is understanding where you are at with your mental health and what you can do to change it.
Makes sense.
Definitely. I totally agree with that. Thank you so much for your inputs. I think one thing that's changed is, you know, the how we see mental health from, you know, our parents and our grandparents and current generations. So what is your perspective on mental health growing up versus now?
I think a lot, I mean, as you imply, Danny, a lot has changed in both the study of mental health, but possibly more importantly, the widespread discussion and awareness of the general public, the media attention it gets is considerably higher. I don't necessarily support that mental health challenges are worse now than in previous generations, albeit there are likely inevitable effects of coronavirus pandemic events, including wars that affect specific people, etc. Let's not forget, as you said in the introduction, one in four people are likely to experience some kind of mental health problem in a given year is the stat that I've read, and that's pretty high. But even more worryingly, or as worryingly, I read that 9 out of 10 people who are struggling suggest that they experience some sort of stigma or discrimination because of it. So my specific perspective, I suppose, is my parents were don't judge me for age, in the 40s, and from not the UK, from Eastern Europe, and my suspicion that in the culture they grew up in, perhaps it wasn't discussed in the same way. Given that I have a family history relating to the world wars and the Holocaust, I imagine there would be deep-rooted and complex issues. I think there's been an immense change in the education. I also happened to grow up in a family where there was an obvious and quite severe challenge. I had a mother who suffered from bipolar, so otherwise known as manic depression. So for those that don't know, in her case at least, it was quite chemical, and it created very long lows up to sort of 9 months and very short highs, like sort of 3 weeks, but it varies. I think that typically is type 2 bipolar, if anyone happens to know about it. But in between bouts of her sort of normal, which inevitably has affected my understanding that it's a very broad and complex spectrum, that it's not uncommon to struggle, and allows me to see the difference between those different types of concerns or challenges that people have. And it's also probably helped me support myself and others later on. And people have worked very hard to make it more accessible as a topic, but we've still got a long way to go.
So I'd echo that it's not something, when I was growing up as well, it's not something that people spoke. A really big impact. And it's something I was diagnosed with anxiety when I was in my 20s. And it's something when I look back on my teenage years, especially, I sort of identify certain instances and go, oh, OK, that was the anxiety. Right. OK, it suddenly makes sense. And whereas I don't remember ever in that time period mental health being something people spoke about, anxiety, it just wasn't something people were aware of. And it definitely wasn't something, then therapy definitely wasn't something that my parents do and that anyone I really spoke to would do, really. I think I started therapy, saw my first therapist when I was maybe 16, but I felt so guilty about it. And that's definitely changed, but it's tricky. But it's exciting to see the change and see how people talk about it now.
Thanks, Laura. Yeah, for me it was a bit like Mike and Laura. In fact, I grew up with two family members, and this is kind of the 80s, who I knew were behaving erratically and oddly, but given my age, I didn't really know what was going on. And I kind of witnessed it unravel, where one particular family member would lock himself in the toilet for hours on end and wouldn't come out. And it wasn't discussed. And then as we kind of moved to probably like 5 years ago, that family member started getting therapy. And it turned out that I ended up using the same therapist as him. But the thing was, it took me kind of 6 months for me to realize I needed to get help, where it took him like 30 years. So I think the big difference for me is that we recognize mental health challenges and we talk about them more. Back then it was just, you just had to kind of get through with it and get on with it. So I'm really glad that we're now in an era where people talk about it more openly.
Agreed.
Yeah, definitely agree. I have also seen that change drastically from growing up to sort of maybe when I was at uni, or over the last 10 years is when I've seen more of this boom on mental health and with its own right. I grew up in Colombia, Guatemala, Peru. I moved around from like the age of 8. My parents divorced when I was 5. So I moved around and grew up with my stepdad and my mom, sort of jumping countries every like 4 years because of his job. And all of this obviously would have caused some trauma, but I didn't really had any time to sort of process anything. It was more like, you need to adapt, you need to make friends, you need to do good at school, you need to learn a new language. And like that, constantly, which has its benefits. Like, I then came on my own to England to study, and I've been here for 10 years and made a life here. And I'm very adaptable to change and in different cultures and environments and languages. But definitely wasn't something that growing up, you know, I didn't have a therapist or a psychologist, even though some friends did have it. So I think it has evolved, and it also really depends on your household, for sure.
Yeah, agreed.
So what is the biggest challenge you've overcome with mental health?
So I have probably three fairly large life events that I've seen an impact on my mental health around. And I think the main thing I'd say about in terms of challenges is I've seen the progression of how I've dealt with that. So I've been really proud of how I've dealt with that. So the first one was in 2015, I moved out to the US with work, and it was amazing opportunity, but it was also around the time I started having panic attacks. And it's obviously a big change to move your entire life over. I did have some friends out there already, but it was really challenging. I was on my own on a project and I started having panic attacks. I'd have panic attacks on projects at work, in the office. And that was obviously the time that we were in the office 5 days a week. So I really struggled with that. And I was eventually diagnosed within about a year with anxiety. And that moment of diagnosis, sort of, I thought there were so many things wrong with me. But as soon as I was diagnosed and we talked through them and my therapist said, oh no, that's all anxiety, it immediately helped. But even then, it took me a long time to understand it and to help loved ones understand. Well, you know, I had my parents, like I said, didn't necessarily get it. I had lots of people say to me, oh, you don't seem like you have anxiety. So it took a long time to understand it. And then the second one was when I moved back to the UK. I moved back in 2020. So I moved back in the middle of COVID. I thought I was coming back for 3 months, just temporarily, while this whole thing blows over. But I ended up coming back, being unable to go back to the US and get all my belongings. My entire apartment was there, all of my things, all my clothes, and I couldn't get back there. And then even once things opened again, we were still blocked from going to the US. So everyone went back to their regular life, saw their friends, saw the as they normally did. And I couldn't do that. I had friends here, but my close friends, the people I'd had my life with before COVID, were over there, and I couldn't get there and I couldn't get my things. So I was really struggling. But again, I dealt with that better than I would have done if my mental state had been the place when I'd moved out to the US initially. And then the third one was towards the end of last year, one of my really close friends died by suicide. And it was understandably a really horrible time. And I had a lot of guilt around it. A lot of the, could I have done something differently? But I also am very proud of how I dealt with it in terms of not completely breaking. I really was able to have that positive attitude about myself, not be too hard on myself, I guess. It's not positive, isn't the right word, but I was able to deal with it better. So I've been able to see how my mental health has become stronger and how my response to difficult situations has become better over time, which is something really nice to reflect on.
That's an amazing story. Thank you for the honesty. I guess I'd add, it would be remiss of me not to say I've also suffered from anxiety, which in my case was often work driven or initiated from work type stressors, which had been ongoing for the best part of 10 odd years, which has led to a whole series of further education for me, some talking therapies, some use of antidepressants or SSRIs to take the sort of edge off, but also led me to want to talk to others about it. So it was interesting that you said, Laura, people saying you don't look like you suffer from, right? There isn't necessarily a look. So one of the things I was going to mention was also, you know, when is it okay to speak out about yourself? Well, whenever you feel comfortable. You know, I've got to the point that always is my answer, because I think it's important to speak about it, whether you are a senior person, a male person, a mother person, a foreigner, a front office banker, a veteran, or whatever you happen to be, whatever it is. And in fact, everybody, anybody, it's okay, because it's part of who you are. But another one that's really important, you used the word guilty, Laura. So my last one that I was going to mention in terms of challenges overcome, allowing myself or oneself, forgiving yourself for having periods of poorer mental health because you feel that you shouldn't, or you feel privileged or less worthy or guilty or something like that, to suffer in some way. I think there's an important message that took me a long time to learn is worth trying to impart to others, that probably segues into conversations about imposter syndrome and the like, that is quite a common challenge and takes a while for individuals to get over, but it's not a sign of weakness. And that it's okay to have the discussion.
Yeah, I agree. I remember from my therapy, one of the things I learned very quickly was the use of the word shouldn't, should. It's like, I should be able to do this. I should get over that. And actually, like, why? Who says? My story is quite an interesting one. I was working in Hong Kong with my wife and my daughter. Our second child was born, and on day two, he was rushed to hospital. And I remember that exact moment, something physically and mentally inside me just crumbled. Like, I don't know what it was, but it was like almost like a snapping of something. And for probably the next 3 months, I was feeling anxious, stressed, burnt out, exhausted, overwhelmed. It just couldn't do the basics of anything. And I eventually got some help where I was kind of put on this journey of Valium to clomazepam to sertraline. It was a real wild ride of medication. And I came back to the UK and got diagnosed as having postnatal depression, which is not something you think you're going to be diagnosed with. But from then, it probably took me, I would imagine, 2 years of sertraline, a lot of therapy to kind of get back to a point where I was able to do the things that I was doing before my son was born. And I remember writing in a journal when I was in Hong Kong, like, I don't feel able to go out for a drink with my friends. I don't think I can do my job. I can't go and play golf. I can't run a marathon. And actually, since then, I've managed to do all those things. So it was almost like I was setting myself a challenge when I was unwell to get better. But the one thing I remember through all that period was the minute I started talking to people about how I felt was the minute I started to get better. And that's the one thing I would urge anyone to do. If you're not feeling the way you want to feel, then tell someone about it.
Yeah,
completely. It's actually very moving to hear all your stories because it makes you open up as well. I feel like I've always had this perspective that, yeah, you can tell your story, but never felt really like compelled to tell mine. Always a bit reserved that what would people think? Will they be judging? And just hearing you sort of sharing everything so openly, one, helps normalize the conversations and remove the stigma, which is sort of the aim of all of these initiatives, but also helps people talk about their things and also process them. My mom had a similar situation with the depression postnatal. So she had my little brother he died upon birth or like 5 days before birth. So he was like a stillborn. So my mom went on depression for a very long time. She then got pregnant with my brother, who's like 20 years old now. And she kind of just had to go and jump straight into it. Didn't really have that much time to process it. But after my brother was born, she then, I guess, never really treated that depression, and she started drinking. And long story short, after years, she became an alcoholic for about, I think, 10 years or 15 years. And again, like, nobody would have guessed. Everyone would say the same thing you were mentioning, like, oh, you don't look like one. Like, you look perfectly fitness, like, you go to the gym, you do all these things. Like, how is that even possible? And obviously, this is part of my story and like how it affected me. Well, I was here in England. I was trying to get a visa to stay in the country because I had finished all my studies and I had exhausted all the options. And at the time, there were no visa sponsorships at Delta. Before I joined, it was pre-Brexit. So the situation was very complicated for immigrants. And I exhausted all the options. I was about to leave, basically, after living here for 6 years and having done uni, masters, internships, work experience. And the only option was like to get married or something like really that I didn't want to do. And I found a route for an entrepreneur visa, which I basically set up a business, a health and wellness business about superfoods. And I managed to secure that visa. And when I had to set up a business throughout those 2 years, and only then I could apply to have the job that I have at Delta now that they didn't need to sponsor me. And then, so it was 2 years of working full time in financial industry, setting up a business to maintain my visa and having a mother on the other side of the world that was going through rehab and, you know, all of these issues. Like, my brother didn't really have someone to help him, obviously my dad, but I think he also has some like social drinking culture. Like, they live in Mexico, it's very similar to the UK. Everything is around going for drinks, I think. And yeah, that affected me in terms of anxiety, yeah, depression. And that's when I found like I was doing yoga. That was one of the biggest toolkits that, you know, maintain me in the right track and just help me succeed in everything that I was doing. Otherwise, it would be a very different story. But we can talk about more about the toolkits and what ways to help our mental health in the next question. But yeah, I just wanted to share that because I know that maybe a lot of us have addiction in family members, and it sometimes is really difficult to talk about. And perhaps you're not the one addicted, but how that impacts you in terms of anxiety and depression and so on.
And especially being in a different country to your family, you know, it's obviously an opportunity, which is wonderful. And obviously you're happy here and that's great, but it's really hard. Your mental health takes a hit. You haven't got the same support network really close to you.
Completely. And obviously you'll be happy to hear my mom's been recovered for about 4 years. She's been 4 years sober and she's doing amazing. Like if you see her, she's 60 years old and she looks like my older sister. No joke. I don't know how.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, she looks really young, but no, she's doing fab and things are going well. But obviously that was a very back then. So on that note, how do we think that businesses and leadership teams can help support employees suffering from anxiety and mental health?
So sadly, in a former job when I was running the office, one of the team members committed suicide. And the big thing for me was that I no way kind of spotted it, or I just wasn't aware that the individual was struggling. So the first thing for me here is if you think any of your colleagues, so I generally have a radar for colleagues, talk to HR. So I generally have a radar for colleagues, just because I think it's really important, because some people just aren't ready to talk. But if you think your colleagues are struggling, you should talk to them or talk to HR. The second point, I think, is as leaders, we should become first aiders or have some kind of meaning or understand neurodiversity or mental health, because it helps to spot people who are struggling and it helps have the conversation and the dialogue. And then thirdly, I think it's for me, understanding anxiety is, specifically anxiety, is people are worried about things that might happen. So be very conscious of the words and your actions with your team, because that can create anxiety in your team. So be very conscious about what you're saying, how you're saying it, because you inadvertently can create anxiety in the workforce, which is clearly not what we want to do, but it can happen sometimes. So I think, you know, education is important, and then just being aware of how you're interacting with your team.
100% agree, Stuart. I think thematically it's about starting to normalize the conversation. What is it? How does it manifest? Asking open questions. But I think sometimes you can, if you feel comfortable doing so, asking someone what their triggers are for stress or anxiety or mental health, because they can help you spot. Everyone's got different manifestations. Google can be a dangerous tool to educate oneself. Education is key. From a management perspective, I would say that managers are sort of the first line of defense. People tend to have a better experience if their manager or management are comfortable to speak about mental health and provide some signposting. Managers have to appreciate everyone's different and affects us all differently. So I think as managers, we should be setting expectations for colleagues and not make assumptions about individuals. We should educate as I think you mentioned, Stuart, mental health first aid. I know that's something that we as an employer have done in the past quite a lot, but perhaps we can educate all managers and leaders to be aware to provide signposting. You know, it's not teaching people to be therapists, not what it's about. It's about signposting people to some support. So our businesses, we can spot signs that employees that may be struggling. We should have good conversations if we possibly can, someone that might need a break or some time. And also, you know, providing any support from the workplace or adjustments that we can do. But in order to enable all of that, just make too many assumptions.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with that more. I think the three things I'd call out that you guys, I think, have all mentioned. One is normalizing conversations, particularly from those senior leaders. Senior leads talking about mental health makes other people feel like they can as well. The other one is everyone needs different things, and understanding colleagues and your staff, whether they're reporting to you or they're newer than you, is really important to be able to spot differences. And then the other one is, Stuart, you mentioned the words that you use. I think that's so important to understand how the words you use could impact other people. I know for myself, the way my anxiety, I'm dealing quite well with it recently, but the moments my anxiety is increased is things like I'll leave a work event and I'll suddenly go, oh my gosh, they said it this way. And did they actually mean that? And did I annoy them? And did I do this? And I worry about what I did. And words, the words that people use, I often will hold on to. If I know that someone's phrased in a certain way, I'll say, okay, it's okay. That's not what they meant. I know that. I know that they still value me. I know that, I know I'm not an imposter, all things like that. But it's something that, you know, a lot of the time people with anxiety can't help doing. They will worry about something, but the scale of that worry.
So important.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I really like that about identifying the trigger within. This is something that I found in Mind Map. So Mind, the mental health charity, and I proposed it as an addition to our policy for positive mental health, so that managers, if they identify with their teammates that someone needs a sample for mental health issue, then build a plan where they can identify triggers and different ways to sort of tackle this or address that. So this kind of ties up with my next question, which is, how do we minimize the stigma of mental illness? I think you've kind of answered that a little bit with the normalizing conversations, but...
Yeah, I think for me, it's important to be open and transparent with your own mental health, because I think that sets an example and it normalized. So I think it's very easy to say we should normalize, but I think it's for actions. So I'm very open with my team. Currently, I'm feeling stressed. I will tell them I'm feeling stressed and I will tell them what I'm going to do about it. If I'm feeling anxious about something that I see on the horizon coming, I will tell them and we will talk about it. So I think it's the actions that you take are really important. The other thing that I think is also super important is it's sharing and celebrating the successes that we have regarding mental health. Like, I'm always hearing about people telling me how fast they run a marathon or what their 10K PB is, but no one kind of celebrates how they overcame a period of depression or how they removed some stress from their life. So for me, it's kind of anchoring more on the positive of, last week I had a really strong feeling of stress for 2 days and I spent some time walking in the countryside. I drank lots of water. I slept really well. And now that period is gone. And I think we don't do a good enough story of celebrating how we manage and overcome our mental illness challenges.
Just you've prompted a thought there, Stuart. There was I don't know, a few years old now, there was a documentary Stephen Fry did that was on the telly, exploring manic depression and the various different approaches to people that have got themselves to a better place. And it ranged from heavy medication, electroshock therapy, talking therapy, etc., everything you can imagine. And at the end of every interview, the question was asked by him as the interviewer, though he suffers himself, if you could switch this off, would you do so or not? And the answer typically was not, because that particular illness for those people was creating the highs that created artistic flair and positivity. But you've prompted the thought about telling stories about some positives or some techniques or some ways or success stories is ever so important, just because otherwise we will continue to perpetuate the mental health is bad. Actually, we all have mental health. Sometimes my mental health is great because I am happy for many reasons. Let's too. Totally agree.
Yeah, I think that's me as well. Just not just saying it's great because of something good happened, but actually getting past a really, really tough time. And I think at least I personally talk to my sort of close friends about that, but not really much further than that. And so I could definitely with bringing that into the workplace and things like that, and making sure, you know, if we all do that, that makes a big difference. The only other thing in terms of minimizing the stigma I'd think of would be calling each other out and holding each other accountable to it. You know, similarly to, I know that there's a lot of things about sexism and calling out your friends if they make comments to women on the street, stuff like that. It, the same goes for if someone uses a phrase, the right phrase to use, call them out on it. Or if someone jokes about someone's mental health, that's not the right thing to do, and that's not going to minimize stigma. You don't know who you're talking to. If you make a joke about someone's mental health, else in the group that you're talking to is suffering from that, you don't know how it makes them feel, and that could delay their recovery for whatever they're going through. You just have no idea what people are going through.
Totally agree. And actually, do more of this, right? The stats speak for themselves. We talked about them before, but the people on this podcast are relatively diverse in background, gender, age, experience, stage of life, and are sharing something reasonably common. And I don't think we've had this coming. You know, most of us on this call don't know this about each other. If it's this group, it's happening all over the place, right? Everybody's affected. So be open to that and realize that you're right.
Yeah, definitely.
Completely. Completely. I did notice that our similarities. It was one of my highlights, actually. So what would be then your favorite mental health support resources to tackle some of these lows, some of this anxiety and depression?
I can take that one first. So I've had a fair few therapists. I've had tried different ones, and therapy for me has been really, really good. I've not really had a consistent therapist for a while, but I've more when come up, I've seen a therapist for a certain amount of time. So that's really helped me. And one of my therapists, the way I found her was through work. So with work, obviously at Delta Capita, we've got the EAP, which is the Employee Assistance Program. And a lot of companies do have that. And a lot of people maybe know about it, but don't utilize it. But utilizing it is so, so helpful. For ours, we can call, it's completely anonymous, and we can vent. So I had a really stressful time a couple of years ago at work, and this was when I'd moved back from the US, so I was going through a tough time personally as well, and I just would call and I'd vent to the person on the other side of the line. They didn't work for my company, and I could get through that. And then I was able in person therapy through there, and I get a certain number of sessions, and I'm able to work through the issue that's currently happening. And that for me has been really helpful, as well as just talking to friends and family and talking to colleagues. I'm always so rejuvenated after a conversation about mental health, as weird as it sounds. I'm always, you know, when you, like you said, Mike, when you find those connections and you realize, oh, okay, we're all going through the same sort of things and we're all supporting each other. It's really, really lovely. And knowing it's not just you. So I think, yeah, a combination of the people around you already and then talking to other people. But I'm a talker, that's probably why.
Definitely. I think, yeah, as you mentioned, like connecting with others is key, and it's great that we have all these resources as well that our employer offers. I think for me also has been really, really crucial connecting with myself. And so through techniques like yoga, meditation, breath work, I mean, they're all part of yoga, but people generally think that yoga is just the physical postures that you do at the gym. But yoga, generally speaking, is in the broad sense, includes meditation, breath work, and even some sets of like behaviors and disciplines. And for me, that's been super, super beneficial. It's kept me on track. It's allowed me to calm my anxiety when doing breath work and meditation in the morning. Like, that is a toolkit that I couldn't recommend enough. It's changed my life so much that I decided to become a certified yoga teacher and started teaching yoga on the side. It's a passion of mine. But yeah, that would be the one that I would advise. As well.
That's great. No, that's really great. Physical health is so tied to mental health, I think, is the thing people don't really think about.
Yeah, let me just jump in quickly. For me, it's trifle. Like, if you think about a trifle and how it has different layers. So we all have different things that help us and support our mental health. And it's a big spoon of all of it once a day. So, and I do think everyone's different, right? So there's no one solution. But for me, meditation every day, 20 minutes in the morning, non-negotiable, has to happen. Then other things, like I, you know, make sure I go for a walk, I get some fresh air, I get sun, I exercise, drink lots of water. But make sure you have a big spoonful of all those things every day. And like, I know when I don't do those things, if I'm too busy at work and I have two or three days where I don't do those things and I maybe have a beer too many and don't get enough sleep, then no shit, I feel like shit. Like, literally, you know, there's a definite correlation between how I look after my well-being and how I feel mentally. So I just make sure I have a good spoon of trifle every day. It makes me feel great.
I love that analogy. I love the trifle analogy. I would wholeheartedly agree that it's not one answer and everybody is different. I'm going to say something that's going to sound controversial, but probably isn't. Drugs. Not a bad word. And I don't mean illegal drugs. I mean legal chemicals prescribed in this case. I'm not suggesting, in my case, it's not a fix for problems. In my case, selected, I think somebody said the word sertralina. That particular one is the one that I happen to have taken most recently, and in fact took this morning and will do tomorrow morning. For me, they've been something that allowed me to take the edge off, allowing me to do other things, whether that be reading, meditation, exercise, etc., talking therapies, blah, blah, blah. I think sometimes they get a bad rep. I think that research on the right chemicals and the right balance of chemicals has gone a massively long way in the last 50 years, such that it shouldn't be about an appropriately sized trifle for you, as you said, Stuart.
That's great. I like that.
I love that analogy as well. And completely true. We're all different, and different things work for each other. And yeah, just need a little bit of a different thing depending on the day. But yeah, certainly working out, connecting with ourselves, medication, if that's what works for you. And I would even just going to drop one last one before I shoot you with some rapid fire questions, which will be cold showers. If you wake up feeling depressed and anxious and just going to have a cold shower after your normal shower, just for a minute, you'll see how your morning will change.
All right. I understand the theory of it. I'm not sure I can.
I do it, and I do my affirmations whilst I do it to keep me activated, to keep me doing something. Because if I just stay there not doing anything, I will feel it more. So I do my affirmations, and then it's like, okay, 2 minutes, great. I think the next stage, what I would like to try is ice baths. But
the Hof method.
Yes,
Wim Hof. I read about that.
Wim Hof from now on.
Yeah, maybe we do a Delta Wim Hof day or something. Try it, Laura. All right, guys. What is your favorite self-care that you do for yourself?
Yes, exercise.
Yeah, walking and life admin. Sometimes self-care isn't a really fancy care thing. Sometimes it's just I feel better after I've got through a bunch of stuff I have to get done, if I have like a life admin morning.
Yeah, for me, meditation. It's almost a bit like putting on a warm, comfy blanket, and it makes me feel really nice and secure and cuddled. And also, inadvertently, you kind of go through a to-do list of things that you're worried about, and you kind of just gently recognize things that you're worried about, and then you push them to one side, and then they come back in, you push them away again. But it really helps me to kind of focus, clear my mind. Things that I either stressed about or anxious about, I can move them away, and you get this lovely warm feeling. So I would highly recommend it.
Agreed. Exercise, running, raising endorphin levels, taking a break away from work. That's working for me at the moment.
Definitely. What are the best and worst pieces of career advice that you've either received to manage stress or to enable better health?
I guess my good one is trying to not make assumptions or forming judgments about others. I think there's something in the mental health first aid that talks about having a container, a beaker, things that happen to you in your life, stressors. And if you get towards the top of that beaker or the beaker overflows, that's when bad things can happen and someone can spot it. Don't make too many judgments. Everyone's carrying something in that beaker, and maybe ask people about their manifestations of stress. Worst advice, probably something along the lines of, you know, managers, or as you start to look after people, you need to be strong and resilient and confident all the time, and you can't possibly have any challenges. I found that it's more effective to be open and vulnerable. Have did that with me, and I hope that others trust me for the same reason. That's good. That's a misunderstanding of what management should be.
Yeah, so I'd say I think the best advice I've been given is problems, taking a break and logging off is better than powering through. If you're feeling terrible, physically or mentally, sometimes the best thing you could do is log off, take a two-hour lunch break if you need to, talk to your boss, but take a two-hour lunch break, go for a walk. You'll feel better rather than powering through, not taking any break, having a sandwich at your desk. And then probably worst, maybe a little bit similar to Mike's personal situation, but there's a lot of stigma around, not stigma, it's not the right word. I'm glad we can edit this because I'm rambling. I would say there is the challenge with being a woman in business is sometimes that you feel like you, similar to what Mike said, you can't, you shouldn't show your feelings. You should be strong. You should be extra strong, and you should show that. And I've even fairly recently seen a video with, I think there's someone who works in HR, gave some tips of stuff she never does. And one of the things is talk about her personal life or be vulnerable. And I just really don't agree with it and the way I like to work or lead. So that, I guess, would probably be my worst.
Thanks, Laura. For me, this bit of advice came from a current team member, and they know who they are. They were basically talking about how being good at your job, hitting your targets, does not equal happiness or achievement. Something to be proud of, right? But it doesn't mean that you're happy. Well, you're happy, basically. And when you run a sales team, you kind of think, well, if I've hit my target, I mean, happiness. If I don't hit my target, I'm unhappy. And that you can't think like that, right? So that was a really good bit of framing for me. The worst bit of advice I've ever got was about drinking to remove stress. So in a previous career, it was suggested that if I felt stressed, I should go and drink a bottle of wine at lunchtime, which I can assure you does not help in any capacity. So don't do that.
Completely. I think that hopefully we're moving towards a direction where we are changing the culture in businesses, especially around financial services, around the drinking situation, because I completely agree with that one. to be fair with all of them, thank you all for sharing your thoughts. And third rapid question to support colleagues and encourage open conversations around mental health.
Yeah, I'll take this, right? So you go, Laura.
No, it's okay.
4-day weeks or giving people space for mental health during the day. I think we all work too long, too hard. And I think employers should be more flexible in terms of giving people afternoons off to go for a walk or encouraging walking meetings or 4 days a week. I just think there's so much, we can be so consumed in that working 50, 60 hours a week that we don't have time for mental health and wellbeing. So I think employers need to be more flexible with time.
Yeah, completely agree with that one. The two pieces I'd say would be it's moving in the right direction. Senior leaders talking about their mental health, you know, it happening more and in more businesses. I think it really kind of can't happen enough. And it doesn't need to be a big conversation, but it could just be in a regular company meeting where they just sort of meant, you know, it's just being a bit more of a more common and being open to feedback and having tools where employees can provide feedback about the support system they feel like they have. And if they haven't got the right support system, addressing those.
Just riffing off that first one about, I think your call was for senior leaders to speak out. I'd go broader and say, and sorry if this is me being a broken record, but tell real stories about real people in many and varied and different circumstances. Some of those might be leaders, some of those might be women who've had a baby, some of those might be veterans, etc. I'm inspired a little bit by a former employer of mine that did a campaign called This Is Me, which I think then went broader than that employer to many other industries. But basically, you know, I am Jenny and I've had this experience and I'm also a project manager and I work here. When it's someone that's past you in the corridor, or even better still, someone that you kind of know, it resonates even more. It normalizes. Yeah. If it's just someone in the media, you don't really know them, so it's okay. But if it's somebody you know, more okay to talk about it. So I take your about leadership, but I'd say it's broader. It's I'm somebody and I've dealt with or I'm dealing with OCD. That makes the next person that might think that they have that or don't want to speak out about it speak out.
Yeah, I've seen the thing before, Mike, where it was a bit like that, but it was like pass it on. So you nominated someone else. So you kind of, you talk about your experience and you nominate someone else and they talk about them and it kind of goes through the whole business. And it's a really nice way of just the whole workforce opening up because it can't just be us four on the call that have had these experiences.
Yeah, totally. And that's something that we're trying to improve in the firm. We're currently improving our policies around wellness, which intertwine with gender and labor and human rights work streams to add wellness leave days to improve the women's health policies. So touching upon what Laura, you mentioned, how we feel that we have to sort of level up to how men behave in the workplace. And so talking about having our period or going through menopause might be seen as weak for missing out or calling in sick, where we're actually trying to implement and bring that and normalize that, you know, you can take time off if you're going through that. And it's absolutely normal. So I think that this is something towards the right direction, as well as these forums, the time to talk sessions, and have leadership and just everybody at different levels will make it will make people feel more relatable and will want to share their own stories as well. So thank you so much for that. And let's thank our guest speakers, Mike, Laura, and Stuart, for their insightful responses and for sharing their experiences and thoughts associated with mental health. A few points that particularly stood out for me were the similarities that we all had, even though we have different ages, genders, nationalities, you know, work, roles, everything. The second point that stood out for me is asking people what triggers they have so that we can better support them at the workplace, having the wellness space at the workplace and increasing the flexibility, as well as introducing things like walking meetings instead of sit-down meetings. And the third point that really stood out for me was celebrating how we've overcome mental health challenges. So not just celebrating that we finished the marathon or that we finished the course, but how we managed to manage our anxiety or to overcome our depression. At Delta Capita, we prioritize mental and physical health through initiatives such as mental health awareness sessions, time to talk discussions, and mindfulness meditation sessions. We support all employees during times of stress, whether that causes are from their personal or professional life. We also share well-being tips via our Live Well, Work Well newsletter. Delta Capita also has mental health champions, mental health first aiders, a wellness committee, and an employee assistance program. Our employee health insurance includes enhanced mental health cover as well. These conversations are vital to how we prioritize encouraging discussions on equality and equity in the workplace. Thank you so much for listening to this discussion, and please look out for more content from Delta Capita on our website, deltacapita.com, our LinkedIn page, and lastly, our Instagram @delta.capita.